Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Getting a handle on your money. If only there were an app for that. Wait, well, there are actually many, many apps out there. But do they actually work? We'll talk to Jen Legere, co-founder of one called Cuber. And we'll look at a few other apps that focus on the teen demographic. Personal finance expert and author of A Parent's Guide to Raising Money Smart Kids, Robin Tobe, will be here. She's going to show us some ones focused on teens. One day, that teen might actually move out of your house. Maybe they'll move away for college or university. Is tenant insurance something worth thinking about? Janine White will be here to tell us all we need to know about tenant insurance for students. Then, Canadians and credit cards. How fast you redeem your rewards might be the key to credit card satisfaction. J.D. Power's first ever study on the topic reveals many Canadians are switching their credit cards for better rewards programs. Jim Miller, Vice President of Banking and Credit Card Practice at J.D. Power, will be here to tell us more. Plus, Canadians are moving on up. On the Natixis Annual Global Retirement Index, Canada rose two spots this year to ninth place. David Goodsell, Executive Director of the Natixis Center for Investment Insight, explores some trends found in this year's index and what it means for Canadians in the future. All that is ahead. Let's get started. Achieving a financial goal can be very difficult without a plan, especially if you can't see that goal being achieved in the near future. But that big vacation you've been saving up for could be closer than you think. Cuber is an app that helps you save money and visualize your financial goals with fun different challenges. Here to tell us more about Cuber is its co-founder, Jen Legere. She joins us from Moncton, New Brunswick. Hi there.
Hi, I'm very excited to be here today.
Thank you for making the time for us. What is Cuber and how does it work?
Cuber is an app, exactly like you said, that helps people save money. And our focus is more on short-term goals. So people create their goals in the app. We use the old concept of saving jars. And people create those jars, could be travel, could be, kids' activities, any sorts of things. And then you determine how you want to move money into those jars. And those are very simple ways. So, the common way is Roundup. You can also take a percentage of a paycheck that comes in. And then, like you said, we have fun challenges, and that's what makes us a little bit different. So we wanted to make it easy and fun.
What is an example of a challenge? And does it involve doing the dab or flossing or wearing a Hawaiian lei around your neck?
Actually, that's a great idea.
You're welcome. I have an 8-year-old, so I sort of know how to floss, but I can definitely dab.
All right. I as well have two kids, so I've learned these dances.
Yes.
So one of our most popular challenges that's happening right now is called the 52-week challenge. And you may have heard about this online. You know, it's taking a certain amount 1 week and then the next week a little bit more and a little bit more, and you build up until you reach. So the maximum that we take out per week is 35, and then it starts going back down. So in 1 year, you've saved $1,000, and you don't see a whole lot of impact on your daily budget, but it's a very simple way to save.
One of the things you mentioned a second ago was Roundup. So there's an app called Milo, which will round up, you know, you go to Starbucks and it's $4.75. They'll take the quarter between $4.75 and a dollar and put it towards something. Does your app do that automatically, or do you have to, does a human being need to make that roundup happen?
Yeah, it's all based on decisions, but no, we do it automatically. So as long as the user says, okay, I want to take a roundup every one of my transactions that I make and put my money towards my travel jar, then that'll happen automatically.
So what is the vault?
The vault is actually an account, a trust account that we have with a credit union. So what happens is when people have these saving jars, money's moving into them, we take the money from the customer's account and hold it into this trust account until they've met their goal or anytime they want to cash out. So the reason that we do that is so that people aren't tempted to spend that money. And they can get that money back at any time. It takes 48 hours. So you actually have to think about it a little bit before you decide, okay, I'm going to spend that money on impulse.
Where did the idea for Cuber come from? How did you come to this?
Cuber is really a personal, you know, I think most of the people that even have worked at Cuber have struggled with finances at one point in their life. So we wanted to do something about it. We wanted to help people who are kind of living this cycle of paycheck to paycheck, help get them back on track, because it is possible for a lot of people. I think a lot of people have the money. They're just making sort of bad decisions with their money. So we wanted to help get them to that next level where they feel empowered, that they feel that they can meet these positive goals and accomplish something with their money.
How does the app connect to financial institutions? Because one of the things that's so critical is that there be a complete circle between any of these types of apps and how we bank. How do you do that?
Yeah, so we connect to most of the large financial institutions across Canada in order to pull the transactions. So like some of our rules are based on the roundup, so we need to see that transaction information. So we're using an aggregator to pull those transactions so people give us access to that through the app. And then also we need the direct debit information in order to move money back and forth between the vaults.
How do you make money? How does your business make money?
So our revenue model is actually to sell the licenses to banks. So what we'd like to do longer term is actually be part of a banking app's offering to their customers.
And so at this point, it is free to the consumer?
Absolutely free to the consumer. That's right.
When they round up, it goes into a savings jar. Is there a scenario in which they would round up and that would go into an investment account?
We don't have investment at the moment, but we are looking into it. It could be a longer-term strategy for us. For now, we're focused on those short-term saving goals. And then as part of our 52-week challenge, you can, if you accomplish the challenge, so we give incentives to our customers. So if you accomplish the challenge, then if you save $1,000, we give you $20.
I'm sure you would be happy for anyone to download the app and use it. But in marketing, we need a target. Who would you say is your target market for the app, either demographically or psychographically?
Yeah, our target market is really people who are sort of in that middle income level who make money but are spending it sort of in the wrong places. So we're targeting men and women, and actually the customers that we have on board now, we have pretty much a 50-50 split between men and women. And men are really our power savers, but women also really like the app, especially the budget challenges that we have.
Credit cards are an enabler in many ways, both positive and negative. How does Cuber help consumers deal with the footloose and Francie freeness of having a credit card that can allow you to buy anything you want any time of day or night?
Yeah, I think that's part of the problem, right? It's become so easy to spend money. So what we do is, that's one of the other things we offer, is these budget challenges. So what we're doing is we understand where people are spending their money, and we know the certain places where they don't need to spend that much money. So let's say we see somebody spending, every day eating out lunch. We'll challenge them to cut back on that spend. And if they do come in less from what they normally would have spent, we move that money into a jar.
And when you say you challenge them, is it a notification like, hey,
yeah,
Bruce, what are you doing? It's not so hard to make a sandwich.
Exactly. So we basically have, and this was just newly put out a couple weeks ago, we have a recommendation. We have a dashboard with a news feed, and in there is personalized recommendations. So directed to you, for me, I like to drink my coffee, so I was getting, hey, why don't you cut back on your coffee spend? And it actually makes you think about those things that, yeah, I probably could cut back a little bit there, and that would be an extra, $20 towards my goal. So it all adds up.
Can you mute Cuber? Because there's some things that, there's surely a risk it's going to come across as a nagging mother or father-in-law.
Yes, you can. So you can turn off the notifications, number one. You can also, if you have sort of a rough week or a rough month financially, just like, school just started, so a lot of people had, a little bit extra financial money going out than they normally would. So you can put your jars on hold. And then once things start to clear back up again, then you can reactivate them and then things move along as they were before.
Interesting. Well, Jen, I really appreciate you taking the time to come and talk to us about your new app.
Yeah, thanks for having me. That was great.
Jen Legere is the co-founder of Cuber, a new financial goal achieving app. She joined us from Moncton, New Brunswick.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Some people are terrified of their credit card, or at least the monthly bill that comes along with it. But the one thing Canadians love about their credit cards are the rewards programs. The J.D. Power Canada Credit Card Satisfaction Study revealed that nearly half of credit card holders switched their card issuer over the past year for a better rewards program. Joining us now from Boulder, Colorado, is J.D. Power's Vice President of Banking and Credit Card Practice, Jim Miller. Hello there, Jim.
Hey, good afternoon.
You led this study. Lots of findings. I want you to choose your favorite and most relevant and resonant takeaway. What struck you most about this research?
Well, after your lead-in, it is the importance of rewards, with customers switching, and when they do, it's typically for a better rewards program. And there are a lot of great rewards programs out there, so I can see why they would want to switch.
On the ranking, the top three companies were President's Choice Financial, American Express, and Canadian Tire. These are not the market share leaders in this country. Did that surprise you that they punched above their weight?
You know, they all have really clear value propositions for their customers. So in some ways, it's not surprising. Now, we might say that, you know, seeing the big five or big six banks, lower in the rankings, maybe that's surprising. But a lot of times, I think I'm going to put a little bit of the burden on the customer there, that those customers might just be, you know, picking a card with their primary bank and not really thinking about it or getting the best card for them. So maybe they'd be more satisfied if they were like the President's Choice Financial customers and shopped around and found the card that was best for them.
I don't think I've shopped around for a credit card since, I don't know, the first Trudeau was in office. It's been a long time, and I cover this stuff for a living. When you look at the rewards that people switch for, what do you notice? Is it air miles? Is it movie tickets? Is it cash back? Is there a theme there?
It's all over the board, depending on the customer. So, you know, the airline miles are appealing to a lot of people, but then they realize that it may take a long time to earn those rewards and they might be hard to use. So in the case of, you know, say a PC Financial or a Canadian Tire, they're looking at where they're already shopping and there are points that they can earn that, you know, are easy to redeem. So those are really popular. Personally, I think cash back, you know, we could all use more cash. It's easy. It's easy to redeem. So cash back is another reason more and more customers are saying, I'll just take the cash.
One of the phrases that you used in your study, which I thought was interesting, was the phrase wrong card. What does it mean to have the wrong card?
So the wrong card is the one that does not fit with your lifestyle. So there are a couple of different cases. One might be you carry a balance every month and you're in a rewards program. You're never going to earn enough in rewards to compensate for the interest that you're paying. So in those cases, those people should look and see, you know, can I find the lowest rate card? And maybe it has rewards, maybe it doesn't, but they would be doing better. In other cases, we have people who are thinking, oh, it's great, I'm in an airline card. And, you know, for those that get to redeem those rewards, that feels really good. But they might actually be earning more if they were in, say, a cash back card or one of these other programs. So it's really customers who, the rewards program or the structure of the card doesn't fit how they use it.
Am I right in understanding that the revenue associated with the study comes from financial services companies? Is that correct? They pay you in some way?
Yes. So financial service companies, they buy our study and we work with them to try to understand their customers better and improve. But, we go ahead and do the rankings. Nobody buys their way into the study and nobody buys their way to the top.
Why is it then that what we seem to always see on the credit card front is more marketing, more rewards, more push on the spending, but we don't see companies take a holistic view and help consumers get a handle on their money? Why is that?
Well, we're seeing a little bit more where financial institutions and credit card companies are trying to get a little bit better of a handle. But there's such strong competition to acquire new customers that so much of the focus is really on rewards because, honestly, that's what customers care the most about.
Many credit card holders use mobile banking apps to manage their accounts, of course. According to your study, mobile usage is significantly higher in Canada than in the United States, which surprises me given that our mobile contract fees are so much higher. Why do you think it is that Canadians are more engaged with mobile?
You know, it's interesting. So we've not always seen that in as the case in other studies, but it's really improved or increased quite a bit in Canada. From a demographic perspective, Canadians tend to be a little bit younger, more diverse, who all tend to use mobile more. And from when I'm in Canada, everybody's attached to their phone, so it's been made very convenient.
Where do interest rates play into satisfaction? I know for people who pay off their balance every month, which is what I do, I don't care what the rate is because it doesn't affect me. But for people who do carry a rate month to month or a balance month to month, it seems like they don't really, really care about the rates, except for at the margins where people are really trying to pay, some sort of debt consolidation game. Is that fair?
You know, I think that is fair. I think customers should pay more attention to it. You know, if you think about it, some customers may not really want to acknowledge how much they're paying in interest and may not feel that there's much of a difference between paying 18% and 14%. But if you do the math, it'd be a pretty good savings if you could find a
massive
lower rate card.
And so comes back to my earlier question. Why don't credit card companies make that a point of differentiation? Is it that it is a negative for all of them if they compete on price?
Well, it is a negative for all of them. There are cases where they do try to compete to acquire customers through lower interest rates. The truth is that the customers that they're all seeking are the ones that spend a lot on their card, and that's really the focus of acquisition. It's riskier to focus on acquiring customers that are already carrying significant balances because they're more likely to default.
Yeah. I can ask you one last question here. What would your message be to consumers to improve their behavior with as it relates to their credit cards? And I'm going to take two off the table. You can't tell me they should pay off their balance every month because I talk about that practically every week. And you can't tell me to shop around for better rewards because we've already talked about that. So in addition to those two tips, what else would you say Canadians should be doing to get the most out of their credit card use?
Okay, well, you took away my two go-to suggestions. The other one I would look at is, what are some of the other benefits that you would get with your card? Whether that be, related to airlines, related to shopping, travel insurance. Some of the cards in Canada now are giving you your credit score. That's been something that's come up in the U.S. quite a bit in the last few years. So I'd look and say, what are some of those other benefits that I can get? And before shopping around, I'd actually say, do I know the benefits that come with my card? And am I really getting everything out of the card I have today?
Really appreciate your time, Jim.
Well, terrific. Have a great day.
Jim Miller is with J.D. Power. He's their vice president of banking and credit card, their credit card practice. And he was here to talk about the company's Canada Credit Card Satisfaction Study. There's a call to action for all of us there. We've got to get more engaged on how we use our cards. Coming up next on Moolala, financial apps for teens. And later, we'll look at where Canada ranks on the Natixis Global Retirement Index. You can email us with any financial questions you have or comments about the show. Our email address is ask@moolala.ca. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Just like grown-ups, kids can have financial goals too. Whether they get a weekly allowance or have a part-time job, one day they're going to need to learn how to budget their own money. There are so many different financial literacy apps out there made specifically for kids and teens that help introduce them to money management in a fun, engaging way. So how do you figure out which ones are going to work for your family? Personal finance expert Robin Tobe is with us. She is the author of A Parent's Guide to Raising Money Smart Kids. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
There are so many of these apps. Before we get into specifics, I would love you to just kind of characterize broad themes you would say that we should be looking for as parents when we go through the app store and like, I don't know, what are the kinds of attributes of these apps that have them be more effective than others?
Well, some of them are just games or simulations, and they're not using real money, but they're designed to allow the kids to experience what it takes to earn money and then the decisions that you have to make once you've earned it about how to save, spend, share, or invest it for the long term. And then there are other apps that are actually you can connect them to a bank account so they can actually be some form of a digital piggy bank where you can even connect the child's allowance and chores and that type of has more of a technical element to it because you're really managing how you allocate chores to them and how you pay them.
I feel so conflicted about the digital element. On the one hand, I want Abby, who's 8, to learn the visceral experience of notes and coins. On the other hand, I know that her entire life is going to be digital. By the time she's, out in the work world, cash is likely entirely a thing of the past. How do you reconcile those two things, as from your perspective?
Right. I mean, cash is already kind of going away. I think for young kids, it's great to start off with a tangible physical piggy bank. And there's one that I talk about often when I speak to parents, and it's the multi-slotted piggy bank. So it has a slot for save, spend, donate, and invest, 4 different slots.
It's the savvy pig. I love the savvy pig.
Savvy pig. It's a great birthday gift.
It is.
So there's actually an app that company has produced called Saving Spree. And it's really just more of a game app, like I described earlier, that teaches kids how to save for goals, spend wisely, donate to others, and invest. So it's consistent. So that approach would work, where you have the physical, tangible piggy bank, where you can show them the bills and the coins, and then you can kind of back that up with this digital game that reinforces the same lessons.
Saving Spree from Money Savvy Generation, that's the first
right.
one. Second one's
right.
iAllowance Lite. Tell us about this one.
Okay, so this one will actually replace the need to have a physical piggy bank with coins and stuff. So let's say you do want to embrace this whole going digital trend. So it lets you manage your kids' allowance. You can set that up as a weekly thing, or you can pay it out for special rewards. It also has the ability to track things like chores around the household and odd jobs, and you can even set push reminders to get your kids to do those pesky chores.
Really? So this assumes that they have their own device.
Right.
So the push reminder would go to my, grade 9 kid and be like, do the dishes!
Yeah, to their phone or their tablet to remind them to clear the dishwasher.
That's how I sound. Do the dishes!
And then, there's ways to motivate them. Like, I think, there's like a system. You can set it up with little stars, or you can actually set it up to use real money.
Bankaroo. Tell us about
right.
Bankaroo.
So this one is a virtual bank, and it's for kids 5 to 14. So again, it's more of a simulation for kids to learn how to budget, set goals, and, save towards those goals, and then how to spend responsibly.
The Game of Life is a game. It's a game from my childhood. I loved that game, and we have played it with Abby too. It has it lives in digital form. Tell us how you would use that to help kids.
Well, it is a classic game, as you said. A lot of parents have probably played that growing up. So this is just a version for $3.99, and it's for kids ages 4 and up. That's on their phone or on a tablet or something, and the idea of life, the reason I think that it's so enduring is because it teaches these real world lessons, like how do you pay for university or college? What do you study? What kind of job are you going to get? Do you want to buy a family home? Do you want to buy a car? So it's really, you know, it simulates the types of decisions that you'll face throughout different life stages. But there was a warning when I did my research that there are in-app purchases.
I hate that. Quickly.
I know. And, that, you know, it's always connected to your credit card. So something to watch for.
Yeah. Abby's accidentally bought things that were not approved. Now, tell us, so all the banks have mobile banking apps.
Yes.
When in a young person's life should that link be made?
Well, I think it should be around the time that they open a youth account, which is usually, I guess, around 12, I would say. Whenever they graduate from, like, you know, a child's account to a youth account, and they get a debit card. Because if they're old enough to understand how to use a debit card and how it works and go to the ATM and take money out, they're probably, and they're always on their phones, I'm guessing, then it's probably an appropriate time for them to start to use the features of mobile banking to manage their money.
The good thing about debit card use that I can see, I mean, this is Abby's too young for this, but I can see them developing a relationship to a piece of plastic that has limits before they develop a relationship to a piece of plastic that doesn't have limits, called a credit card.
Right.
How else do we use technology to train our young people in that very important distinction?
I know. I mean, one of the things I say in my book is that kids really do need to understand the difference between a debit card, which takes the money out of your account right away, versus credit, where it's buy now, pay later. I mean, the thing about these mobile banking apps by the banks is that they contain other tools that will help you manage your money. For example, you can set alerts to notify you if your account balance is running low, or let's say your Visa balance is starting to hit like a high number if you're approaching your credit limit. These apps will also track your spending, so see where you're spending money and categorize that, and then it will use that information to help you set budgets. And obviously, setting a budget is one of the best ways to control your spending. And then again, these alerts will notify you if you're hitting a certain number that's your budget for a certain category.
What is the role of parents as it relates to your kids, their money, and these apps? And I ask because some things we as parents just completely outsource. I barely even sit in the swimming pool while Abby has her swim lessons these days. Like, they just do everything, and I reap the benefits of the fact that she can swim. That is not the same when it comes to great financial behavior. What role do we as parents need to be playing, even if we've paid the $8.49 and bought the app?
I think the most important role that parents have is to be good financial role models for their kids. So try to get your own financial house in order first so that you can lead by example. And that means, you know, using mobile banking or online banking yourself and trying to stay on top of your money with those tools. And your kids will see that you're doing that, and they will hopefully emulate that kind of behavior. Because, you know, being good with money and being able to manage it well is a good habit to get into early, and that you want your kids to establish early. I mean, the other role parents have is to be that person that your kids go to when they have questions about money or when they want to learn, because our kids do want us to be good financial role models. And a study by CPA Canada showed that kids who are taught about money at home are more confident and optimistic about their financial futures and better prepared for the decisions that they'll face. So in my opinion, no app can really replace the value of ongoing discussions with your kids about money. So not just like the one money talk, not like one and done, but ongoing conversations. And they're easy to have because money, you know, the subject of money and how to use it is coming up every single day with your kids. So just look for a teachable moment.
Where do you net out on paying kids to engage in this content? It was kind of a surprise to me that this was even a thing, but I was talking to someone and it's like, yeah, we pay them. We pay them to watch or learn. We pay them to learn. And obviously, please, paying kids to do it, anything, they'd sit there and do it. What do you think?
It's a slippery slope.
Yeah.
I think once you start paying them to do something, I mean, and then that gets back to the allowance and chores thing, and there's always debate about that too, right? But I think in general, bribing your kids, whether it's for good grades in school or to learn something like this, it's not the right way to approach it, because I think you want this to come from within. You want them to, and that's your job too, to explain to them, why is it important to be good with money? You know, why is that a life skill that we think and the Canadian government thinks and a lot of people think is important to have? You can be honest. What mistakes have you made when you weren't as well informed.
Are you talking about me, like, in theory or as a human being? Who are you? Do you think you're talking to me? I'm perfect.
I know. So am I, right? I wrote the book, of course.
You did.
But we all make mistakes. So it's okay to share some of those mistakes with your kids and really explain to them, you know, the world has gotten complicated and you need to be, you need to have the knowledge and confidence to make responsible decisions throughout your life.
Robin, thank you very, very much for your insight on this. I appreciate
it. Thank you, Bruce. Talk to you soon.
Robin Tobe, the author of A Parent's Guide to Raising Money Smart Kids. We were talking about a bunch of apps that you can at least consider. iAllowance Lite, Bankaroo, The Game of Life, and Savings Spree were the ones that we mentioned today. Stay with us. Coming up later, we'll take you through the Moolala questionnaire with Jen Legere. But next, Kinetics.ca. We're going to talk insurance, tenant insurance for students. And Kinetics personal finance expert Janine White will be here. You can follow me at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. I am so not a student anymore. Stay with us. There's more Moolala after the break.
Listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Picture this, you're 18 years old and just moved out of your parents' house. You're somewhere in college or university living all on your own and you're finally free and eating ramen noodles for every single meal. Now, the last thing that's on your mind is tenant insurance, but maybe it should be one of the first things on your mind. Well, certainly after the ramen noodles and making sure that that's stocked as well as the beer fridge, but all that said, we're going to talk about tenant insurance for students. Joining us is Kinetics personal finance expert Janine White. Hello there.
Hi.
I'm a big fan of tenant insurance in general and quite shocked about how low the rate is for all Canadians. So I think this applies to everyone. But before we talk about the student element, let's talk about what it is and what it covers.
So tenant insurance is for somebody who's renting either a house as a student, maybe a room in a house with roommates, or even if you're renting a condo, it covers basically your liability and your personal belongings.
So if there is a theft, someone comes in and robs my house, my fantastic Mac is sitting on there, I've got, you know, whatever other valuable students would have, then it's a traditional insurance claim?
Yes, it is. Usually those things you talked about is those personal belongings that we're most concerned about. And even if you take that laptop with you to campus and it goes missing there, it also covers that.
What kind of a deductible? I know we're not doing a specific quote here, but what's the range on a deductible?
So the deductibles you can typically choose yourself. The higher the deductible you pay as the tenant, typically the lower your premium is because it's the risk that you're taking on personally. So they can start as low as $200 and go up from there.
What's the ballpark cost for a policy?
$20 a month.
Right. So not a lot. $240 a year.
Absolutely.
And I think the liability piece. So I get the burglary, like I lost my laptop or whatever. What is the risk on liability front? On the liability? I've heard lots of people who've been robbed, but not lots of people who've been caught in some sort of circumstance where liability would have to kick in.
Yes. And actually, that's almost the most important part to think about because the contents can always be replaced. But you don't want to face yourself being sued for somebody who gets hurt on your property. And you are liable for it. If somebody does come into your property, they trip, they do something, they have a big claim, you're on the hook for that. That's what you want to protect yourself against.
How does this connect with the homeowner's policy? Because if I'm the landlord, I've got something for the physical environment. Where does their liability stop and where does my liability start?
So for the landlord, they're primarily responsible for the building and entranceways to the building, the common areas. But it doesn't help you as the tenant if someone gets hurt in your property, in your space.
So give me the rationale on why student renters should consider this.
So first of all, the one thing you've already pointed out is that it's fairly inexpensive. The second thing is, even for that inexpensive cost, if you're thinking about the long game, that actual experience you have in having a policy and being a policy holder for a couple of years because you're going to buy a home will actually help you save money in the long run.
So is this something that a student would sign up for themselves? It wouldn't just be under their parents' umbrella?
So that one's an interesting question, because if you're staying in residence, or in some cases, if you are a university student and you're just moving into the house or the rental property, signing that 8-month or 1-year lease, actually a lot of times your parents can actually just extend their policy to you and it doesn't cost you anything.
Huh, so not even the $20.
Correct.
If they don't and it needs to be layered on, is it better to add the additional insurance on their policy or, to your point about building up some history, to mm-hmm. set up the policy yourself?
So what's interesting is that there's property policies out there that actually already have it included. You just need to let them know. So certain companies, for example, will have $10,000 or $15,000 worth of tenants coverage that they can actually extend without any increase in cost on their current policy. It's just about letting them know.
Oh, we are so lazy. should we expect that our insurance brokers will ask, do we have any kids? Are they going to university?
Well, your broker really should know. I mean, if you've got your auto with them and you've got your home, I mean, a great broker will know your family. And yes, the ideal situation is they come and say, hey, you know, is Johnny going to university?
Right.
But no, at the end of the day, just make sure you give your broker a call and let them know how your family is changing, because it could actually change your auto insurance policy too.
Yeah, and note to listeners, your broker won't know. I just had this thing with our our cottage insurance, and we had not changed the amount insured in 18 years because
yes.
I'm a dope and didn't think to change it, and no one ever asked me.
No, and we don't wake up in the morning going, I think I'll call my insurance broker today. But you're right, it's about education and it's about understanding when your life situation changes, usually your insurance needs change too.
Yeah, which sounds like a really bad TV commercial
it
when
does.
You say it like that.
Agreed.
I'm sorry, I don't take that
nope,
personally.
I agree.
But it really is true. It's one of those.
It really is true.
There is a difference between all risk and named perils, which mm-hmm. is about as jargony as you can possibly be. Everybody needs to take an espresso shot or something to listen to so they stay alert during your response.
Yes. So for all risk, which is typically what your broker will recommend, is that basically it is covering all of your belongings. The other side of it, with certain various exceptions, if there's a very expensive piece of artwork, maybe it's not going to cover that. When you have a named peril, it's naming the risks that that the policy covers. So it's going to cover against wind. It's going to cover against all of the types of risks that are out there. So you have to basically run into naming one of the risks that actually that's the one that had to happen. So if it wasn't one of those risks that happened that destroyed all your belongings, then you don't have coverage. Mm. So all risk, it's going to cover all of your belongings. Potentially that expensive painting, if you've got it included and listed on the policy, it's going to cover it all for a variety of risks, and that's what your broker will recommend.
I don't think I'm going to take my Monet to my dumpy ghetto house.
No, maybe not.
Maybe not.
No. So now, just be careful of those assets,
yeah.
That's all.
What is the portability of these policies? Because when I was in university, I think I lived in the same place twice, but mm-hmm. mostly I just moved around. That's just what we did. So if you have a policy, can you call up and just say the new address is, or does it require a rewrite?
No, it usually is just call up and the new address is. It may change the rate slightly. Where you live does impact what the rate is. So it may change it slightly, but it's typically the same policy, just an update.
Now, we've discussed the benefits. We've talked about the low cost for tenant insurance, mm-hmm. and yet the number is, I don't know what the current number is, something like 50% of all renters of all ages don't have tenant insurance. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is?
Because I don't think they're thinking about the liability aspect. I think when people think insurance, they're thinking their belongings, and if I lose my laptop, I'll replace it myself.
Right.
But what they're not thinking about is the, you know, the $1 million liability that may come with someone getting really life-altering injured on your property, and that's where your finances will take a huge hit.
Is it because, so if you do not have tenant insurance, if you are faced with this, obviously the percentage, the risk is very small in percentage terms, but is this this kind of thing that force someone into bankruptcy? Like how do they come after you?
It can. So you personally get sued. And so you are responsible. If someone tripped over your rug and they got, you know, hurt and they can't work anymore, they need accident benefits, it will become part of a lawsuit, and you don't have anything, any insurance backing you up if that lawsuit comes
to bear.
So
remove all rugs from home. Don't yes. cook ramen noodles in boiling water. Use lukewarm.
Absolutely.
And I think you're never host you're a good. Kegger.
Exactly.
No, these are students. They're hosting keggers. It's just how it's going to go. Thank you very much for your insight, Janine. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Janine White is personal finance expert with Kinetics.ca. Stay with us. Coming up next, how Canada made it in the top 10 on this year's Natixis Global Retirement Index. And we'll take Cuber's Jen Legere through the Moolala questionnaire. You want some more Moolala? Download and subscribe to the podcast version of our show on iTunes. You can also listen to it on Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and Google Play. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
Listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Canada made it into the top 10 this year in this latest Natixis Global Retirement Index. We are up to 9th place from last year's 11th spot. So what was behind the move? Are we getting better or are other countries getting worse? Dave Goodsell is Executive Director of the Natixis Center for Investment Insight. He is here to tell us more, joining us from Boston, Massachusetts. Hello there.
Hi there.
We're in pretty good company here in the top 10. Switzerland, Iceland, Norway, they're the top three. What do they have that has them score so very well, even better than us?
Well, what I'd say is the Global Retirement Index is designed to be multidimensional. So if you're thinking of, you might see in a magazine, best places to retire, learn more about where are the policies and finances set up to make a more secure retirement for individuals. So the case there is that we see great balance in Northern Europe and the Nordic countries around the different factors we look at, whether it's health, material well-being, quality of life, finances and retirement. And you tend to see that in particularly in the Nordic countries because their culture is built around collectivism, the whole idea of helping everyone there. So it's not just healthcare, but it's, you know, income equality, and we even see higher levels of happiness there.
Now, I wasn't surprised to see the Scandinavian countries because they always seem to do so well in studies like this, but I was surprised that Australia was that high. What are they doing that is similar or different to not only what's going on in Scandinavia, but what's going on in Canada?
Well, Australia, it's similar. I'd say it's a case of countries rank well across the board if they're in the top 10, and maybe slightly better in certain indices compared to the other top 10. You know, one of the things we know in Australia is that they have been looking at their old age dependency, for example, and they've looked at immigration policy as a way of improving that. Of course, old age dependency means the number of people age 65 and over per 100 people in the population. The lower that number is, the better it is.
How does Canada score on that particular variable?
Canada actually is increasing its old age dependency like most of the developed world. So we saw a slight increase in that for last year. This year. But, overall, Canada has got really great, well-balanced performance around the different factors.
So to my earlier question, are we doing better or are other countries doing slightly worse, allowing us to edge up two spots?
The answer to that would be yes and no. I think what we've got here is a relative index. So there's 18 different variables we look at. And in some places, Canada performs better. In other places, it may perform slightly lower than others, but the key to being in that top 10 is really about the well-balanced environment that's there for individuals who are looking at retirement.
You outlined the five key threats to retirement security. I'm going to go through them, but I'm going to seed my question first, and that is, what do you think is most worrying for Canada? That's what I'm going to ask you. The threats are monetary policy that's perpetually stuck in crisis mode, the growing weight of public debt, old age dependency keeps growing, climate change, and an eroding quality of life for retirees. When you think about Canada, which of those five is the one we should be most concerned about?
Well, when I look at the data, one of the things we see is that perhaps one of the places Canada went down a little bit this year was public debt. And that's been a challenge for most of the developed world. You know, during the past 10 years, when we've been coming out of the global crisis, we've seen global debt go from somewhere around 65% of GDP up to 85%. So really almost a 41% increase in how much debt there is in the developed world. So that's something to watch. On the other side of it, though, I think interest rate movement appears to be upwards. We see that in the U.S. as well. That's one of the things we want to watch, because low interest rates may be great if you're saving for buying a house or buying a car. But when you're trying to save for retirement, you can't generate the necessary income off of it. Or if you're annuitizing your in life savings, you can't get the income that's sustainable from that.
Four of these five make total sense to me. I totally get it. The one outlier is climate change. It seems kind of shoehorned in there. Like, I don't know, someone just said you had to throw that in there because that's what people are talking about with all the crazy weather we've been seeing. I'm sure that's not the case. Tell me why.
Well, to be honest, we've been measuring that as part of the index since we began it 6 years ago. And one of the reasons we include it is because climate change has a specific impact on retirees. Now, if you're someone who is living in the Carolinas, maybe you retired there, and you had your house damaged or destroyed by the hurricane 2 weeks ago, now you're faced with the proposition of living on a fixed income, having to rebuild your home, or having to rebuild it for maybe the second or third time to new standards, and your insurance rates are going up. So if you can't afford that, you may have to move, which means you've got to find a place where you can replicate the kind of safety net you've built for yourself around having the right doctors, having access to Social Security, all the things that help you feel more secure in retirement. Mm. So it's actually a very important threat to consider.
Yeah. Now, there are so many stakeholders here in terms of affecting retirement readiness. There's government, there's financial institutions, but there's also individuals. We as, you know, human beings have a role to play here. What would you say are the specific things that we need to be doing as individuals, even if we can't count on government or industry to help us? What can we do? What's within our circle of control?
Well, I think the simplest thing is to take advantage of whatever retirement savings vehicle you have at your disposal. You know, whether it be a registered account that allows you to get the tax benefits on it, personal savings accounts, it is something that we're all going to need to save for in the future.
If there was one policy intervention that you'd focus on for the Canadian government, I'm not asking you to be political, but you've seen that you've got the data right in front of you there. What is one that we could make a change on that would improve our score here?
Well, it would be hard to pin just one thing that the government could do to improve retirement.
You could choose two.
Oh, it could choose two. Well, you know, I think it's difficult to do that. I think because we look at so many different factors, the pieces to really be aware of is really protecting what's there that's succeeding. So managing monetary policy is very helpful to retirees. It's also very helpful to pension funds. So the problem with pensions is when rates are really low, that means that their current value is low of their investments, meaning their liabilities in the future are greater, and they have to take on much more risk to meet those liabilities. So managing this from a perspective of what's best for the country overall is really the way to look at that.
Really interesting stuff. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dave Goodsell is Executive Director of the Natixis Center for Investment Insight. He was here to talk about their Global Retirement Index, in which Canada moved up two positions from 11 to 9. Hooray for us. Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire. Jen Legere is from Cuber, which is a savings goal app. She's in Moncton, New Brunswick today. And Jen, I'm going to ask you a whole bunch of questions, and I'd like you to give me the first thing that comes to your mind. Are you ready?
Ready.
How would you describe your money personality?
Stubborn.
Stubborn. What does that mean? I've never heard that one before.
I guess right now I'm on a mission with Cuber, so I'm very stubborn that I'm going to stick to my goals, and I have a lot of budget challenges going on.
Yeah. Who was your money mentor growing up?
My mother, definitely.
And what did she demonstrate in word or deed?
Oh, my goodness. My mom was a very excellent saver.
Really? Can you give me an example? Did she save elastic bands and bread ties?
yes, all of the above. You know, coupons and just putting money aside whenever money came in. That's the first thing she did, was put money aside.
What is one financial behavior you'd say you're still working on?
I would say probably my coffee spending habit.
Really? What's your favorite coffee order? If you didn't have to worry about the price or anyone judging you, what would be your favorite coffee order?
That's so easy. It's a grande latte
blonde roast from Starbucks.
Oh, wow. That's relatively simple. I mean, surely there could be another 18 descriptors that would really make that barista earn their paycheck.
That's true. I like it simple, I guess.
Now, what would you say, bigger than coffee, what would you say is one of your guiltiest spending pleasures?
Probably yeah. Shoes.
But shoes?
No, travel.
Oh, travel. Okay. And where is one place that you have traveled to that was you kind of like, oh, I can't believe I spent that money, but it was totally worth it?
Let's see. Probably Sydney, Australia.
Sydney? That's not an inexpensive flight, Sydney, Australia. Nice.
For sure. But it is an absolutely beautiful place.
It absolutely is a beautiful place. What does financial freedom mean to you?
Financial freedom, I think right now for me would be to have, I'm working on my rainy day savings, so I want to have 3 months of savings built up. I've continued to put money in my RRSPs so that I can hopefully retire when I'm around 60 or 65.
Yeah, yeah. And what will you do if you retire when you're 60 or 65?
Travel.
Do you think you'll be one of those people who is binary in their retirement, as in work, stop, travel? Or do you think you will be sort of combined work and leisure in the next chapter of your life?
Yeah, I could see definitely working part-time at least for a long time.
Who are some of your favorite personal finance inspirations? Authors, speakers, TV shows, blogs, books? What has influenced your thinking in this area? In addition to your awesome mother. I say hi to her, by the way.
I read a lot. I used to use a lot of apps like Mint. I use Pinterest a lot, actually, which is probably an odd answer. But
for your, you used tell me more about that. That somehow that relates to money?
Yeah, there's
how?
Lots of good saving tips and saving ideas on Pinterest, and lots of blogs and
how to make a money saving jar out of a piece of fabric and a bow with a glue gun.
I'll be honest, a lot of the challenges and things that we have ideas for have come from Pinterest.
I'm going to have to look into that. What is one money topic that you could talk about every single day and never get bored?
Cuber.
Okay. All right. Then give me a second one too.
I would say probably budgeting, like spending less on things that you don't really need.
Yeah. If you could snap your fingers like this and change one financial behavior in society at large, what would it be? Aside from using Cuber, got it. Yeah, uh-huh. Aside from that.
Well, they could use Cuber to do this, but I would say save first.
Save first, pay yourself first, whatever cliche you want to use. That is a great tip, and we will end it there, Jen. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jen Legere is a co-founder of Cuber. She joined us today for the Moolala Questionnaire from Moncton, New Brunswick. Well, that's our show for today. If you want some more Moolala, you can go to our website, moolala.ca. You can also listen to prior episodes of the show either through the website or you can go to iTunes and download the podcast version of this show. You can also write a review there. You can subscribe to it there. And not just iTunes, any of the podcast services out there like Stitcher, etc. Hey, I'm also the money columnist for Money Sense, which is an online personal finance magazine. You can check out those articles at moneysense.ca, then search for me or just read everything because everybody who writes there is amazing. Thank you very much for joining us. Go out and get a handle on your moolala and have a great day.